Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-3068, United States of America versus LeVar Sims, also known as VAR, appellant. Mr. Hart for the appellant, Ms. Danella for the appellee.
If it pleases the court, my name is Dennis Hart. This morning we're asking the court to consider the case of LeVar Sims. I didn't know the VAR had made it into the official record, but his name is LeVar Sims, and his nicknames are VAR and I believe Daddy, as the court will know from the record. We've raised two issues in our brief. We'd like to concentrate on just one, that is the voir dire issue. And we'd like to begin our presentation with a bit of a language discussion. When I went to school, back in Texas, we were told in school that voir dire was to speak the truth. And that's how we operated for a long time. And when I prepared for today's presentation, I asked some French speakers what voir dire meant in French. And they said it's two words that mean to see and to speak, implying that voir dire in French is to see the person when they speak the truth. And I think that's an important distinction.
How did truth get into see and speak?
Well, because I think there are some assumed words there. The assumption is that people are going to say the truth. But our point is that it's important to see them speak the truth. And I suppose that you can argue that, well, people speak the truth when they don't raise their hand. But that's not the same as seeing them speak the truth. And that's what we feel is the critical issue in Mr. Sims.
What was it about the questions that were asked that's significant to this case? I mean, because as you know, we have, although we've made it clear that we do not like this practice, on a number of occasions we have affirmed district court judges doing it, all the while admonishing them not to do it. But it seems the standard that we've created is it's not going to be an abuse of discretion unless it goes to something significant in the case itself. What's significant in the case itself about the questions that were,
well,
compound questions that were asked here?
The questions themselves, first of all, I'd like to say by that policy, the court invites repeated assertions of error in this area, because when the trial court frames its questions, it really doesn't know how the facts will come out. And it may be a witness is important that it doesn't think, and so it phrases a question in a particular way, thinking it's protected under this court.
You're asking for a rule, no compound questions ever?
Yes.
Okay, obviously that would be different from what we've held.
Yes.
At this point. Okay.
But it would resolve a lot of the problems which earlier cases have created. Now, I think that...
What about these questions?
These questions, one of the things that we agree with the government on is that the defendant below showed no prejudice, the kind of prejudice that was required in Little John and wasn't sufficient in West, for example. There were police officers that testified, but that wasn't a police question that the trial judge asked in this case.
So, Mr. Hart, did you just say that you'd agree with the government that there was no prejudice?
That we can show no prejudice. We can speculate on the prejudice. This wasn't brought to the attention of the trial judge, and I could do that now to show you why it's important, for instance, to know that a juror has been on a grand jury before, or whether the juror has served in a criminal case. In this particular case, a trial lawyer would want to know if a potential juror, had sat on a case involving prostitution, or child abuse, or child prostitution. That's very important for a decision-making process in selecting the jury. But what this process does is we think it has two dangers. When you have a fact question followed by the other part of the compound, an opinion question, in any context, what you have is you have the jurors self-selecting themselves. That is, they can answer the question yes or no as to the fact question, but they believe that the opinion question absolves them from any problem. That means that you aren't getting the truth. That is, you aren't, because you don't see the person speak the truth, That person is self-selecting the voir dire, and it's the juror that's doing that, not the lawyer.
Counsel, the government makes the argument that these questions, in any form, need not have been asked.
Well,
if that's correct, the rule you advocate, that if they are asked, they may not be asked in compound form, doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense. In other words, if they could not be asked at all, some information is surely added by their being asked in compound form. There will be at least some, there's at least the possibility of a juror registering on the first question and then registering affirmatively on the second question. So why isn't what the district judge did here an advance, modest perhaps, over what he might have done?
Well, I don't believe that the one area that the government cited in their brief is, I believe, service on a grand jury. That
I thought it said broadly that none of these questions is required to be asked.
Well, it may have said that. Of course, the cases that it cited, I believe there are three of them, one from Second Circuit, Fifth Circuit, and Seventh Circuit. This court has never adopted that position, that specifically that membership on a grand jury is not a question for which a defendant has no right for. If the court wants to make that, it'll have to make that in this case, but it's not held that before. But if you look at the cases the government cites for that, and there are Ruggiero, Bolland, and I'm going to mangle this, Stasek, I think. In Stasek, you'll find in all cases that there are other alternatives for the information provided to the trial lawyers. And in Stasek, the court said there is no requirement that a matter be explored in numerous, substantially similar questions with tedious repetitions of only slightly variant shadings of meaning. You can read behind those words to garner the fact that the trial court in Stasek, at least, said there was no general requirement for these questions because the lawyers asked so many questions of the same kind with just different variations that they had that information. That same thing can't be concluded in Mr. Sims' case. There is a second danger to compound questions, though, and that is when you have the opinion and the fact question, not only do you have the problem of self-selection by the jurors, but you also send out the wrong message to a juror. Remembering that the goal of voir dire is to learn the truth, a juror is sent the wrong message when they're given that compound question because, call me a cynic, but while there may be some people that tell the truth because it's the right thing to do, a lot of people tell the truth only because they're afraid of getting caught, because there's a punishment involved, and that's why we put jurors under oath, because we want to impose on them the hardship of telling the truth, even if it's uncomfortable, because it's important. But when you pose compound questions, you send a mixed message that's the wrong message for a juror. You tell the juror, well, did you do a fact? But if you did A, would it affect your judgment? That way a juror knows that whether they did A or B or not, they can always absolve themselves by saying, well, yes, I may have done this.
I'm sorry, you lay great stress on the juror, the candidate juror actually speaking, but even if these had not been compound questions, wouldn't it have been the usual procedure that the judge asked the question and asks any juror who has an affirmative response to signal to that effect. So a juror can create a false record just by sitting in his seat.
Yes, but... perhaps I didn't explain...
On the juror standing up and articulating something false or true is beside the point, isn't it?
No, I don't think it is in voir dire.
How is it relevant to your issue about compound questions?
Well, as I said, we cannot demonstrate a biased juror. We did not interview the jurors. We did not determine there was specific bias. What we can say is that we don't know, and we don't know because of the truncated voir dire. A person is entitled to an impartial and different jury. And I don't think the court can say that Mr. Sims had that in this case. And they can't say it because He was not permitted to ask some very fundamental questions about prior service, about associations, about the participation in crime prevention activities. And because of the way they were asked, it is not a reliable indicator of negative response when no one raises their hand, as we tried to point out. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hart.
Good morning. Elizabeth Dinello for the United States. We recognize that the court has discouraged the use of compound questions.
I think your counsel at trial tried to do the same thing.
Well, frankly, Your Honor, the government doesn't like that procedure either. But as West and Harris show, such questions are not inherently improper. Appellant's suggestion that the court adopt a flat rule banning compound questions would be inconsistent with a well-established rule that the mode and manner of voir dire is left to the discretion of the trial judge. And in this case, the judge did not abuse his discretion asking five minor questions in compound form.
Why do you call these minor questions? Your opposing counsel says they're fundamental questions.
Because
you say they're minor. What's minor about these?
None of those questions, Judge Griffith, were of any particular significance to the fairness of the jury in this case. It's not to say that, given some other facts, one or another of these questions might be significant. Take, for example, the neighborhood watch question. If this case were a shooting of someone who was shot because of his involvement in a neighborhood watch organization,
What if there had been prior jury service on a related case on a related matter? We just don't know, right?
But there's nothing inherent that suggests inherent bias by prior membership, either on a grand jury or on a petit jury, and we've cited some cases where courts have found it's not an abuse of discretion to decline to ask such questions.
Mr. Hart just made the point that you can't show bias because the voir dire was truncated by the nature of these questions.
This was not a truncated voir dire. This was a thorough voir dire. There were numerous questions asked in one-part form.
Except that there was no way to probe the first part of the compound question.
But these particular questions were not questions that were, in the words of West, of substantial import to the case. Whether a juror, for example, had known another juror in some previous incarnation, or whether a juror had previously served on a grand jury, were not issues that went to the potential bias of any juror in this case, because the issues in the case...
Maybe not in themselves, but don't they open the avenue for questions that might get at that bias? Isn't that the argument, that just cut off by removing those areas from any inquiry, there's no way to discover if there might be a set of circumstances in which there actually is bias?
But the Sixth Amendment does not require inquiry into every area of possible bias. All the Sixth Amendment requires is that the voir dire be subject to the essential demands of fairness.
Obviously, the trial court judge thought these questions were worthwhile, right? And so,
So
he had discretion to ask these sorts of questions. It isn't the only inquiry. What's starting down that road? Is he going to end up at a destination that's meaningful?
The fact that the judge chooses to ask questions which were not necessary to ask in the first place doesn't mean it wasn't within his prerogative then to streamline the process. The judge was careful.
The question here isn't so much streamlining the process as just not getting at the purpose of the questioning in the first place.
And perhaps
arriving at an unfair conclusion on a topic that apparently he thought was worthwhile pursuing, but just didn't pursue it in a way that would lead to discovery of bias.
One of the reasons that the court has been concerned about compound questions is where the first level of the question raises an issue which is of importance to the trial, on which either jurors cannot be trusted to then assess their impartiality in the second part of the question, or where the question addresses a fact that the parties should know about in order for the judge then to be able to make a determination of bias.
Isn't the mere asking that first question here a signal that the trial court thought that these questions were worthwhile asking for those reasons?
The court's decision to ask those questions indicates that, for whatever reason, it chose to ask those questions. That doesn't mean that the court felt that had reason to think that the jurors would be unable then to take the second step and address their impartiality. Let me note, by the way, that we don't know why the judge chose to ask these questions, because the record doesn't reveal whether these particular questions were given at defense request.
Presumably he thought they went to whether you could impanel an impartial jury, right? That's the purpose of these questions, right?
But there's nothing to suggest that the judge, in choosing to ask these questions, felt that the jurors would be unable to take the second step of assessing their impartiality. Furthermore, other questions that the judge asked addressed some of the issues that underlay these questions. For example, the question about prior grand jury service. One of the reasons that defense counsel liked that question is that it probes whether jurors might be confused about the burden of proof and might be willing to convict based on the lower standard of proof that's required at the grand jury level. But the judge did ask in single question form, this is at page 19 of the January 22nd transcript, would you be able to follow the instruction that the defendant is presumed innocent and that the government must prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? That question's in single part form, as is the follow-on question, pages 21 and 22, whether the jury could follow its duty to convict if it found the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, or its duty to acquit if it was not convinced of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Also, of course, we have the kitchen sink question, as the judge called it, and as it's also well known, at the very end, about whether there's any reason that the jurors would not be able to decide the case fairly and impartially.
You don't have any trouble to imagining that in another case on completely different facts, any one of these questions might have been prejudicial.
And that's the whole point about voir dire, and that the court so emphasized, and
well,
is that it turns on the facts
about,
and circumstances.
It's also the point
case.
About Mr. Hart's suggestion of a blanket condemnation of this practice, because the case hasn't unfolded at the time of the voir dire. And we've had to reverse one or two of the four or five cases. This is the fifth case coming from the same district judge. And one or two have been reversed. The others have not. They get opinions. And it's a burden on everyone involved, and I'm not sure why there's any commensurate or perhaps any benefit.
Whether there's a benefit or not to this practice, and there is a benefit in terms of speeding up the process, and I think that everyone has an interest in efficient.
Speeding up the process by creating an issue for appeal time after time? I don't think so.
We have heard that Judge Leon is no longer using compound questions.
I haven't heard that. Have you heard that?
We have heard that in our office. I had thought that we were done with this issue with Mooling, but this case also appeared.
It's not in the record, is it?
But if the court were to adopt a flat rule, again, as Judge Ginsburg, you've noted, because there are so many variations as to what questions are required, when they are required, and when there would be substantial prejudice to the defense, a flat rule would not be appropriate. The court has long recognized that this is a matter of trial court discretion.
Have you urged Judge Leon not to give up the practice?
Excuse me, sir?
Have you urged Judge Leon not to give up the practice?
Because the appellate division has other things to keep it busy, so we'd be happy if this process did end. But
okay,
we don't
think
the way...
Now we've got everybody in agreement. So why don't we stop here?
We don't think the way to end it is to impose a flat rule. And particularly in a case like this...
What is the way to end it?
Excuse me?
What is the way to end it? Another admonition to...
Well, if the court found, as we believe it should, that these kind of questions are the kind of questions that are appropriate for compound form, then I think that we've got some parameters.
That wouldn't be good because, as you say yourself, in a particular case, they wouldn't be.
Although the questions that are asked here are fairly standard, and they're not, it would be an extraordinary case where any of these five questions would be relevant to the issue
of
the trial.
Well, certainly where it would be revealed to be relevant.
Well, where the facts of the trial would be such that these questions would matter. I mean, certainly the district judge has gotten the message about the questions that gave the court concern in West and Littlejohn about asking about law enforcement connections. The court now asks that in single form question, asks the Ridley question in single form question.
But you also say the court asks all questions in single form.
No, it doesn't ask all questions. It asks all but the five that were asked here.
I thought you were saying that Judge Leon had changed his practice altogether.
That is our understanding, that he is no longer asking compound
in
questions.
In any setting, for any questions.
That was a compound question.
And like the jurors in that case, I will answer right. The single question. And just finally to note, appellant's counsel has conceded the second part of the test, which is substantial prejudice. And we'd note further that there was such strong evidence of guilt here.
No. All that Mr. Hart conceded was that he couldn't show substantial prejudice, perhaps because of the compound nature of the questions, not that it's not. He's not conceding there is no substantial prejudice.
Well, but actually, the concrete information. The concrete information is in the first part of the question.
Yes.
So that we could look at the record and see. In fact, everybody has really, and find that none of the five factual points, even if the answer were affirmative to them, seems likely to make any difference.
That's right. None of, and that goes back to the basic point that none of these questions bear on issues that were significant to this case, but also where you do have, as in this case, such strong evidence of guilt, corroborated evidence of guilt, that the court identified in West and again in Harris as a significant factor to support the trial court's procedure.
You mean to say harmless error?
Well, the court didn't frame it as harmless error.
No, in terms
in
of
West.
Your argument right now. That's what you're suggesting, isn't it?
Well,
there was overwhelming evidence.
I'm reluctant to use the phrase harmless error because that's not how the court has framed it. In West, the court says there are two standards that have to be met in order for us to reverse. There has to be abusive discretion. We will not reverse absent abuse of discretion and a showing of substantial prejudice. The court in West never used the phrase harmless error, nor did it in Harris when it also upheld the trial court's use of this procedure.
But let's think of Mr. Hart's point as being the suggestion that in light of experience for prior cases and of the facts of this case, that it is an abuse of discretion to ask compound questions, per se.
Then the court's inquiry would be, has there been a showing of substantial prejudice? Appellant has not shown or even identified how he was prejudiced by this procedure, much less has he established the substantial prejudice that would be necessary for reversal.
So in West, those were both necessary conditions.
Those are both necessary conditions for reversal.
So the court could find an abuse of discretion here,
but find no substantial prejudice. And as in West, many of the factors that are relevant to the abuse of discretion inquiry, including the rest of the voir dire and the importance of these questions to the issues in the case, those also play into the second half, the substantial prejudice inquiry. But what's added in that second half is the strength of the evidence, and the court in West and Harris also says we look at whether there was an allegation of actual bias.
I get the impression that you are quite reasonably more confident of the lack of a showing of prejudice than that there was not an abuse of discretion.
Actually, I don't think that's a fair characterization of our position, Your Honor, because we feel quite strongly that given the nature of these questions and given the rest of the voir dire, that this is an example.
And given the five times we've been up here.
Well, in West, where the question was really much more important, the question there that was at issue was whether the jury had been.
Mr. Per se rules always, or at least should always evolve, or usually anyway, evolve from the accumulation of specific experiences. So that one then reaches a per se conclusion on the ground that it's so improbable or unlikely, sufficiently unlikely, that the practice in question is innocuous, that it's not worth repeated inquiries. Right? That's why we don't have specific inquiries into price fixing as opposed to a per se condemnation. It's why in Microsoft the court said that per se condemnation doesn't apply to certain perhaps tying activities in that case, because there's no experience prior to that.
But all I'm saying is that if what was really a more central question in West, that asking that question in compound form was held not to be an abuse of discretion, which was the court's holding in West, then here where we have questions which do not relate to any of the issues in the case, then similarly, we believe the court should find it was not an abuse of discretion to use a compound form.
Is West the most recent case?
West was the original case. No,
the original case, before we had any cumulative experience.
Well, you can accumulate the experience, but it's our position that there was neither abuse nor substantial prejudice.
Our experience has shown two things, maybe more. One, extraordinary persistence, but on the second question, the existence of any prejudice, we've not really been educated, right?
That's right. And just going back to the first point about the accumulation of cases, the court in West, and it has not backed down from this, the court has said, we do not suggest that single-form questions are required in every case. It depends on the facts and the circumstances. That has been the court's holding. It has not retreated from that holding. And if, therefore, compound questions are allowed in some circumstances, it would seem that the questions here are prime examples of questions where a judge appropriately can use compound questions. I know I've gone way over my time. Thank you for your patience.
No,
you haven't even yet finished your time.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've seen the red light.
And yellow. My copy of the government's brief had no table of contents or table of authorities.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Judge Williams.
That may have been a special deprivation for me. I don't know about my colleagues anyway.
Would you like a clean copy? I have one here.
Sure. Thank you.
Let's see.
Let me give it to the
court. Okay.
I did have one question on a different topic. At 21 of your brief.
Which I no longer have in hand, so you'll have to help me out.
You want mine?
Mr. Hart will lend you a copy. You say, the evidence also supported Blair's testimony that she was transported across state lines for the purpose of prostitution.
I'm sorry, are we on the same page?
Top of 21?
21, excuse me. Yes, sir, go ahead.
Okay. And then you itemize, presumably, the evidence that you think supported that. There's no dispute that she traveled from North Carolina, that she was arrested in Washington, that the erotic ads for her were on the defendant's computer, and that she said this is why she had traveled across state lines. Nothing in this itemization says that the defendant had the intent to transport her across state lines at the relevant time, which is to say before she arrives in Washington.
Blair also testified that before they left that he was planning to take her to Washington where there was, quote, a lot more money. I'm referring you to page 6. And that once there, they would engage in escort service through Craigslist. And she earlier had...
That is her testimony.
That is her testimony.
Your statement here is that the evidence also supported her testimony.
I'm sorry.
She was transported across state lines for this purpose.
Okay. There was...
Is there any corroborating... I realize that the status of corroborating evidence has evolved over the years. I'm asking whether there's any, though...
Because
these don't seem to do it.
Right. She was the only witness who testified as to the interactions with the appellant prior to coming to Washington. The corroborating evidence is once they reach Washington. She did, however, testify that he told her that their purpose in coming was to engage in an escort service where money rolls in for having sex.
He told her that.
He told her that, according to her testimony. But the fact that they then did engage in prostitution activities, for which there is corroboration, quite significant corroboration.
Well, sure, but it doesn't go to the question of his intent when the act was committed. I understand that her testimony doesn't necessarily have to be corroborated, but
right.
I'm asking whether it was, since you seem to have suggested that it was substantially.
The fact that they did engage and he did supervise her prostitution activities once they arrived in Washington, that she was staying in his house, mm-hmm. And indeed that was where a lot of the activity started from. That's where the hotel receipts were found, for example. A reasonable juror could infer from that corroboration that his intent in bringing here was to engage in that it wasn't just a plan that popped into his head once they came to Washington, because one might question why else he had brought her to Washington than to engage in what was seemed to have been already an established prostitution scheme.
Was there any prostitution of her by him or involving him before they came here?
According to her testimony, it was a little inconsistent, her prior statements and her trial testimony, but she ultimately testified at trial that she did not, or the prostitution activities she described at trial all began in Washington. However, she did describe at trial a day trip that the group took to another city in North Carolina, hoping to set up an escort service there. They couldn't find room at a hotel.
Involving the defendant?
Involving the defendant and Blair. They couldn't find a place to stay, and so they went back to Greensboro. So there's the liquor house, which was not direct prostitution activity that she was engaged in, but she did talk about how men touched her body and how she was dancing naked for them.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Allen.
Thank you.
There are two points I'd like to make. Number one, with regard to Judge Ginsburg's question about the sufficiency, my recollection of the record is that the victim came to the District of Columbia and said she engaged in advertising herself. And her first several incidents were not prostitution. They were scams on clients, where she would demand money, go to a hotel room, take the money and leave. And it was only after they wised up, in her words, that she engaged in prostitution.
So it may have been a scheme to transport her here for the purpose of
fraud. That's a possibility.
Fraud.
There is no way, yes. The second point I wish to make is that it may be well and good that the trial court in this case has changed its ways, but the government has taken 96 months out of Mr. Sims' life, and he thinks they ought to play fair. I'm the one that has to go to explain to Mr. Sims why the judge doesn't do it anymore, so they're not going to reverse your conviction. And he's going to ask me, well, why is it that of the five questions that aren't important anymore, the government objected to at least three of them and said they were unfair? And Mr. Hart, you're going to tell me now that the court doesn't think they're unfair? We agree on the five questions, and if the court looks at the record, the government objected to three of them as being improper compound questions. And I can find no better reason to explain to the court why those questions are important when the government counsel says they are. We'd submit.
Mr. Hart, I know you were appointed by the court to represent Mr. Sims in this case, and we thank you for your assistance. Mr. Nello, thank you. Case is submitted.
Case number